Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce to you someone who really is out there where the rubber meets the road, trying to help folks with these substances even before it's officially permitted to do so. This is Dimitri Mobengo Mugianis. And the Mobengo is an African middle name you've adopted in Gabon, right? Yes. So Dimitri not only works here in the States, but also goes to Africa and participates in the ceremony, and I believe has become a very serious devotee of the Ibogaine religion. Let me read to you his bio. Dimitri Mobengo Mugianis is a founding member of Freedom Root, the Ibogaine Project. He's an Ibogaine treatment provider working in New York City and a Bwiti initiate and Naganga, thank you. Dimitri is co-founder of Vocal NYC, Drug Users Union, and has spoken around the world about drug users' human rights, harm reduction, drug policy, and Ibogaine. He's been featured in numerous publications and media outlets, including the NPR's This Is American Life, and his work is the subject of an upcoming documentary by Michael Negroponte. Dimitri recently returned from his most recent trip to Gabon, Africa, where he participated in several Bwiti initiations in Pygmy, Fang, and Sogo villages using the sacrament of Iboga. He's a poet, musician, and lives in Brooklyn with his wife, Roman. It is my great pleasure to turn you over to Dimitri.
Thank you. Let me start out the way we start out any sort of ceremony or gathering in the Bwiti way, a call and response. I say Bukai, you say yay, I say wane, excuse me, I say Bukai, you say I say wane, you say yay. Bukai! Wane! Base, base, base. I'd like to thank the ancestors and the spirit of this plant and all the plants that have brought us here. It's been a journey. I pour libations for the ancestors. This is going to be a little different than everyone else here tonight. I thank Neil and the conference for having the courage to bring me up here in the field of all these PhDs and MDs. I think I'm the only GED here represented. I'll just start out by giving you a basic overall. There's no studies that I'm involved in. This is just drug user to drug user. Start out by talking about who I was before Iboga. I came to New York in the early 80s to be a poet and a musician, and you know, and I was experimenting with drugs and found myself seriously dependent on cocaine, heroin, and methadone. I lived for several years, my late wife and I, with Herbert Hunky. For those of you who know who Herbert Hunky was, the first person ever to shoot up William Burroughs, amongst other things. So he was sort of a teacher of mine. And I became seriously dependent on drugs, on heroin and cocaine and methadone. And I believe that the poppy is a teacher plant, and so is coca. I just learned my lesson, and I couldn't get out of it. After 20 years dependence, I went from being a musician and a poet, living in New York, to living in my parents' basement, turning 40, unable to find a vein, unable to basically do anything. I ceased being a writer. My whole focus was getting and acquiring drugs. My first thought in the morning was death, and my last thought at night was killing myself. I didn't see a way out. Over 20 years ago, through a friend of Herbert, a mutual friend, I heard about Ibogaine the way a lot of drug users hear about it. We were shooting up, and this guy, Adam, told me, a good friend of mine, that there was this thing that he did in Holland that got him off of drugs. He was doing this with a needle in his arm. But it was really an impact moment for me because I remembered it for the rest of my drug use. And I knew there was something out there because I tried everything else. I tried the replacement therapies, and they're good for some folks. They just didn't work for me. Basically, I'd go to the methadone clinic and shoot up in the parking lot. It got to a point. I'm Greek. You can tell by my middle name, Mubengo. It's a Greek name. I'm Greek, and my family was going back and forth to Greece, and I never went, and I had a physical hunger, which is curious because it was an ancestral hunger, to go to Greece. I hadn't been in 30 years. And my only goal in doing Ibogaine was to go to Greece, come back, and continue dying. The spirit of this plant, and God, if you will, had another plan for me. I went My family and friends raised money to get me to Holland. I went to Holland on 100 milligrams of methadone, about $200 to $150 worth of heroin, and enough cocaine to cause serious psychosis. I missed the psychosis, I guess, on my own. Anyways, I went and I ingested the sacrament of Iboga for the first time in my life. And I get emotional when I talk about this 6 years later, because since I put that plant in my mouth, since I took the sacrament, my life has grown in ways that I can't believe. I can't believe I'm talking to y'all right now, you know? I took the plant, I was in Amsterdam, okay? I was in Mecca for heroin drug users, and I had no desire to use heroin. I went through two incredible days where I saw visions that would come true 5 and 6 years later in the bush and on the streets of New York. I woke up without the desire to use, and I just remember saying, praise God. I could not believe it. I went to Greece afterwards, and I wanted to spend a month there. I spent 3 months there. Came back with the passion of a zealot. I wanted to take this to my fellow drug users and let them know, to take it to the folks that didn't have a family, the folks that might not be able to leave because of legal reasons or family issues, or the folks that couldn't leave New Orleans because they didn't have a bus fare. So we started a couple years later. I worked every day. I just knew I was going to do this. And I met a guy named Eric Taub, who's done incredible work with Iboga. And we decided we're going to come back to New York, and we were going to treat 80 junkies in 2 months, and we're going to train 10 people, which was completely fucking crazy, okay? It was not doable. But what we did was we just went out, you know, with the enthusiasm of the ignorant, I guess. And we started passing out flyers in front of methadone clinics in Harlem, 125th and Park, and we started reaching out, and we started to do these treatments on a sliding scale, user to user, and we learned as we went. We learned a lot. There was a guy named Freddie the Dealer. Freddie would pass out Ibogaine pamphlets when he sold heroin, and he was our first client. And it was quite a day. He was an alcoholic as well as a heroin addict, and he went into the DTs right after the Ibogaine treatment. He went through the withdrawal from heroin, but he went into a convulsion. This was my first treatment, okay? He went into a convulsion, and I learned a lot. He didn't die. We got him to St. Vincent's. He did great. He did great for several months until he started dealing again, but which brought us more clients, but that's a whole other story. With Eddie, I realized that I had to step it up. I had to really ask people the things that youth professionals do all the time, ask people the same questions in 5 and 10 different ways. That was about almost 5 years ago, and things have really changed. We're still doing it on a sliding scale. We're still doing it in hotel rooms. We try not to do it in apartments anymore. I'm still meeting people in Washington Square and Union Square. That's where we do our intake. But we've learned a lot. And one of the things that we've began to incorporate into this treatment is the use of Bwiti, the technology of Bwiti. I've been to Gabon now 3 times. And I have noticed that the technology involved with that, the things that the Bwiti do, can help tremendously in this process. What do I mean? The Bwiti is the original dance party, okay? We went there and we would initially have folks just lie in a dark room. We'd give them a small dose, see how it affects them, and then we would start to dose them as they got sick. Now we have music. Eddie the Dealer is now playing the harp. We're dancing, we're singing. The initiation, I've been initiated, it has helped me understand the use of Iboga. There's 20,000 years. This is something that we shouldn't ignore. There's 20,000 years of pygmy use of Iboga and Bwiti. I'm not an expert in Bwiti, but I can tell you a little bit about it. The pygmies have been eating Iboga, the root, for over 20,000 years. And what happened is the Bantu people, who are the descendants of most African Americans, had come east. And they were agrarian people coming east looking for land. And they met the pygmies, and there were some of the same clashes that happened when agrarian people meet hunter-gatherers. But there was the sacrament of Iboga. And the folks that understood that they shouldn't exploit these people, the pygmies, were the folks that went in and started eating the sacrament of iboga, and they developed bwiti. And there's a parallel between drug users doing it and oppressed colonial people doing it as well. A parallel that was noted by Fernandez from the University of Chicago when he did a talk about the drug user-propelled movement, because this is what this is. This is a drug user-propelled movement. It is a movement of oppressed people taking it on themselves to do something for themselves. It was discovered, the anti-addictive effect was discovered by Howard Lutzoff in 1962. He was a 19-year-old college student who was addicted to heroin, who took a dose of iboga just for the experience and woke up the next day realizing he wasn't physically dependent. It's an undeniable opiate interrupter. Now, I don't have the research to back that up. I've got 200 people that I've treated, and nobody wants to kill me. So if you take a junkie into a room and you tell him it's going to do something, I can walk down, and it doesn't do it, I'm going to get my ass killed. So that's my evidence. It's the only entheogen that can do this. Now, people have anecdotal stories about someone taking some acid and coming out of it. Yeah, that might happen once or twice. If that happened with acid or psilocybin, there would be a lot of people who are physically dependent seeking that. This is the only entheogen that does that. I think that's really important in how this relates to the wider entheogen movement. Because although we can tell folks that this has changed my life, I feel better about my mother, I'm at ease with my sexuality, in terms of like the straight world, you know, they might just say that's some tree-hugging shit. But if you tell them that an opiate-dependent person, a heroin addict, took it on Monday and Tuesday is not physically dependent on opiates, that's a door in. And I'll give you an example. I've had many examples. But there's a guy named Al, a young guy who lived in Jersey, who's here right now, but I won't point him out, who's addicted to heroin. He's a Cuban descent. His mother was a hardworking immigrant woman, never read Terence McKenna, you know, never read any of this esoteric shit, just went to work every day, got her little house in Jersey, worked 60 hours a week, and her son is sick in the basement doing dope every day. We take him, and I remember because when the mothers come and drop someone off, especially an ethnic mother like that, she put a lot of pressure on me, and I remember her saying with tears in her eyes, you know, take my son, take care of him. He went through the experience. He came out the next day, or 3 days later when we dropped him off, tired, but no longer physically dependent. He's had his ups and downs, but he's doing really good. A week after I did this, I got a phone call from his mother saying that she has a friend whose daughter was really depressed, wanted to kill herself. Do you think this could help? She made the jump. She made the jump. And I think that is significant, and that maybe is part of what iboga can bring. And I'll get back to what I was talking about, oppressed people. I feel, and I'll just say it, God picks the lowest of the low. Pygmies, Bantu, colonized junkies to be the messenger. And this is one message, and I think it's a doorway for all these plants that we know what they do. But if they have a bunch of junkies, and there's a bunch right here, but you don't have to watch your wallet, because they ate the sacrament. And you can do all the tests you want about safety. I was in Gabon for probably a total of 4 months out of the last year, four and a half, and I've seen it taken by children, pregnant women, dogs, and birds. So what I call that is the pygmy proof. It's pygmy proven and junkie tested. Ibogaine also represents a choice for drug users, for people who have no choice. Especially because it is a drug user community. Listen, I'm all in favor of testing and bringing it into the institutions, but we got to remember what those institutions are. Do we really want to bring these beautiful substances into these fucking hospitals? I don't know. I mean, maybe we have to change the hospitals because they're not temples. They're not temples of anything but public health bullshit, okay? Forgive me. Ibogaine represents a choice for drug users. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. There's a guy named Charlie Bag of Donuts, okay? And Charlie Bag of Donuts was a Lower East Side character an incredible character. And Charlie had been through a lot of stuff over the last 20 years. Prison, child abuse. You couldn't walk into a store with Charlie. He's a brilliant guy, but you couldn't go into a store with him because he was going to boost and fill up his pockets, you know? And he also had some mental health issues. they didn't call him Bag of Donuts for nothing. And Charlie had done Ibogaine years before and came to accept his gender identity issues. Once in a while, Charlie wore a dress, you know. But he was homeless. He was poor. So my thing was like, am I going to give you this? Are we going to give you this and then put you back in the homeless shelter? You know, it wouldn't be fair, you know, to have this incredible life-changing experience and drop you back into the shit. And so he kind of agreed with me. He was a smart guy. And one day I got a call from him, and he was frantic. So I went and I met him. We were walking down Lafayette, and he was screaming at cars, and he was saying, everybody has told me no. My welfare worker told me no. I've been to too many detox, so I've used up my card. They told me no. The social services told me no. The homeless shelter told me no. And now you're telling me no. So I said yes. And we did it. And he went back into the shelter, and exactly what we thought would happened immediately. But 10 days later, he went and met his parole officer. Something clicked. He said it clicked a week later. He called me up 4 days into it. You know, he said he was totally wasted. He said, I just hit a lick. You know, I got 500 Oxycontins, a mountain bike, and a bottle of Viagra, you know? And I was like, Charlie, be careful. But something clicked a week later. And Charlie he got off the paper, got off the probation, got off the parole. Parole, yeah. And he split, and he went down to a southern state. And he's doing good. He's working 12 steps, which is one modality. It doesn't have to be everyone's, but it's working good for him. So he made the choice. And this isn't just for drug users. You know, this is something that I had to come to because I didn't want to have anything to do with some yogi, high colonic woman who wants to, you know, I don't know what, you know. At first, that was my prejudice. Until I ended up doing a session for a friend of mine who was busy, an Ibogaine therapist, with a guy who was an accountant from Chicago. And you see my look on my face. I mean, that's judgment on my part. You know, 2.2 kids, you know, he was having some problems. It turned out to be one of the most significant treatments on my side that I've ever had. And it really opened me up to bring more, to do this work with other folks. I've seen incredible things happen besides the drug dependence. People coming into themselves in terms of sexual identity, abuse, abandonment, and just also that well-being that we're talking about that's so hard to define for something. You know, I'll tell you, we've also been working with therapists who have been using Ibogaine during their sessions or before their sessions. We give someone a dose. I do a little bit of this, you know, a little bit of Bwiti before we start, and then we send him in. And it's been remarkable work. There's a guy named Jay who just went in to a session last week after doing a low dose of Ibogaine. This is low dose therapy. And he was able to recover a suicide attempt that he completely forgotten. One of the problems with this is it sounds like snake oil. It sounds too good to be true. And that's going to have been one of the big issues that we've had with explaining to people. And folks like me are out of our minds because we can't believe it. I can't believe it. But virtually every user, whether they go back to using or not, has reported a positive effect, at least to me. Not everyone has the same experience with drug sensation, you know. Some people have to do it over and over again, or some people do it and get better with their drug use. In terms of a harm reduction tool, I've seen people change the way they do drugs from shooting to sniffing, maybe a little bit less chaotic. Maybe there's longer periods of time. There's a young guy named Mike who had been using Ibogaine. He's used Ibogaine, I think, he's here, I don't know exactly how many times, I won't embarrass you, but I think 12 times in the last 5 years, a full dose of Ibogaine. It's a lot. And you might say that is a failure, but what we've seen, other than the fact that he quit his normal job, I mean, that happens a lot too, he has lessened his use. Over the almost 5 years, he has gone from using every day, and this is a guy who's gone through 30 detoxes, 30 or 35. What that cost you as a taxpayer is, I don't know, for those of you who pay taxes. But what I've seen, what he's seen, is that his use has gone down. He's gone from shooting drugs to sniffing drugs, which is significant in terms of harm reduction, and he's used for probably a total of 8 months over the last 4.5 years. That's a success. I want to talk a little bit about the Bwiti effect on my practice, I guess you would call it. Neil introduced me as a psychotherapist a little while ago. I was looking behind me, trying to find out who he's talking about. The Puiti, like I said, it's the original dance party. It's the original trance party. It's hypnotic music. It's there's a beautiful sacrament in the middle. The guy who's laying down or the woman who's laying down is taking a lot, but everyone takes a handful. Now I don't do it by myself. I bring the community in. And we're in a hotel room in Jersey. We got our face painted. We're playing Puiti music, and we're elevating the person there. And I've seen incredible results from that. People getting up and dancing afterwards. I mean, folks do a... what would I call it? Like a psycho spiritual journey back and forth to Gabon. I mean, people see the Puiti. And when I went to Africa and I talked to the pygmies and I say, you know, people come here. They're like, yeah, we've been to New York. You know, they're coming over here. And I'll give you an example. We were doing a cleansing ceremony, which is basically where someone washes themselves before an Ibogaine ceremony. And what it is they call it a confession. I think that's a holdover from the Catholic's influence in Gabon. But it's about cleansing yourself and getting rid of everything off of your body. And I really want people to be thorough. And there's a small little ritual, and this will give you an idea of technology I'm talking about, where it's a divination tool where I crack a little nut called banzi, and I chew it up, and I spit it around, and then we throw it on the ground to see if everything's been washed off. And I was telling you about the young man that did the small dose therapy, who recovered the suicide memories and really went into that. He had gone through, and he thought it was totally thorough, and the divination said, no go. You know, you got to go back. And that's when he recovered probably the most significant event in his life that he had suppressed. And with that, he went in to the therapy. And from what he's told me, it's been an incredible couple of weeks since then. So that's just one example of the way the Puiti has been working with. This is also the meaning of hard drugs and entheogens, also the meaning of class and race. Because what I'm looking out here is basically middle class to upper middle class white folks who can pay $30 at the door. This is a place where class and race meets, because it's a junkie propelled movement, and it's coming from Africa. And I think that is significant. I think that's something that in the wider drug users movement, in a political sense, is very significant to Puiti, to Aboga, and to Ibogaine, both here and around the world. And I think it also raises issues about the drug legalizing drugs, you know, and where we stand with that, and the right to choose whatever medicine we want. I'm going to conclude right now, but I want to tell you a story. I'm not going to be able to come here tomorrow. My dear friend Adam Nodelman, the first guy I told you about, who told me about Puiti and Aboga and Ibogaine, the first person I ever heard the word from, who was involved with Nico Adrian and the Drug Users Union working against the demonization of drug users, passed away from an OD. 3 weeks ago. And he was probably the most Ibogainized person on the planet. He did Ibogaine, I think, 15 times. But was it a failure? I don't think Adam's life was a failure. I don't think his use of Aboga was a failure. I don't think his working with other drug users was a failure. He just couldn't hang on. He leaves 3 kids. He was an amazing musician. And so tomorrow is his memorial service. And I'd like to sort of dedicate this time to Adam, and for those other folks who never saw their Puiti, who never was touched, at least he was touched and held by this plant and transformed. He used again. He used recklessly sometimes. He OD'd and he died. But he was fundamentally changed, and he changed many people's lives. This is a powerful tool. I know we're sort of like on the fringe of the fringe. We're the crazies amongst the crazies. But this has changed our lives. And I'm just going to conclude the way we conclude in Gabon when we want to say amen. If you agree with me, I'm going to say basse, you say basse back. Basse, basse, basse! Basse! That's all I got. Thanks. Any questions? Yes, sir. Here and then the former colonial masters in France and Belgium and a few other countries. So there are there are places where you can go with a doctor. If you're trying to do not do this by yourself. I believe in a right for anyone to choose to do whatever they want. It is dangerous. I didn't go into fatalities. There have been fatalities. You need to get an EKG, preferably a stress test if you can afford that. Make sure your liver's healthy and make sure you do it with someone who knows what they're doing. You can get on the internet and ask around. There's some really good folks. You can go to Ibogaine Dossier. I'm going to be putting up our site. Freedom Route will be up in a few more weeks, which will be a clearinghouse. And if you want to talk to me, you can talk to me later. Any other questions? Yes, yes. You know, it was about someone who had a heart valve surgery. Immediately, I would be too scared to do that. I would have them talk to a doctor, an Ibogaine doctor in Mexico, or if they can talk to me and I can put him in touch. But I would be really scared to work with someone with a pre-existing heart condition. Yes, sir. Okay. I've done over 250 Ibogaine sessions, and people are very addicted, really fucked up. I mean, up to the point of $200 a day sometimes, massive amounts, 10, 20, 30 Oxycontins at 10 milligrams or 30, major addiction. Anybody else? Okay, thank you.